Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Can we really leave the month without a salute to June brides? Weddings may be lavish or intimate, relationships light and breezy, or rocky and complicated. Whatever the circumstances, the elements are there for wonderful storytelling. I've researched new titles on the modern state of matrimony. The brides and grooms we'll spotlight are not sweet young things luxuriating in love's first blush. They're complex couples of different ages and stages, some in relationships you'll find wickedly funny. My guest today is a distinguished writer who explores vulnerable hearts and our fulfilling and unfulfilling lives alone and with others. Let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. The book report begins with best-selling author Debbie May Comber, who's got wedding bells in her newest title, Blossom Street Brides. Lauren Elliott has waited years for her long-term boyfriend, Todd, to propose, yet he seems more focused on his career than their relationship. When Lauren learns her younger sister is pregnant, she feels overjoyed, yet disheartened. She's unwilling to put her future on hold any longer. Lauren makes a bold decision, one that leads her to a man she could have never imagined as a partner. Beth Ann Scranton is newly married to her second husband, Max. But with Max's job in California and Beth Ann's in Seattle, their long-distance marriage is becoming difficult to maintain. To complicate matters, Beth Ann's ex is trying to win her back. Romance and lives intersect in unexpected ways, with the neighborhood knitting store, A Good Yarn, at the center of the action. Cassandra Campbell narrates.
Lauren Elliott had received the most depressing news of her life. Her sister was pregnant. Her younger sister. Oh, she was happy and excited for Carol, but mingled in with the joy was an undeniable sense of envy. The fact that Carol was about to become a mother shouldn't have come as a shock. Her sister and Jason had been married for 2 years, after all. Lauren loved her sister, and Jason would make a wonderful father. What bothered her was the fact that at age 34, Lauren was still unmarried. Single. Oh, how she'd come to hate that word. Walking down Blossom Street, Lauren buried her hands deep into the pockets of her fawn-colored rain jacket. Tulips and crocuses bloomed in the flower pots that hung from the streetlights, and the scent of roses, lilacs, and camellias followed her as she walked past Susanna's garden, the flower shop. Lauren kept her head down as she mulled over this latest development. This was it. The end of her rope, the line in the sand. She was finished waiting for Todd to give her an engagement ring. A year earlier, she'd had the DTR, defining the relationship talk with Todd, and he'd assured her that marriage was definitely part of their future. Only he wasn't in a financial position to make the leap just yet. He'd suggested they give it time, and she'd reluctantly agreed. That was 12 months ago, and frankly, her patience was shot. She'd dated the popular local television newscaster for 3 years, and it was time to own up to the truth. If Todd was sincere about wanting her for his wife, then she would have had a diamond on her ring finger long before now. Clearly, Todd enjoyed their relationship just the way it was, and in some ways, so did she. Todd was fun and smart, and she liked being with him. Because of his job, Lauren frequently accompanied him to high-profile social events. As a result, she was able to mingle with some of the city's elite, and it didn't hurt that many of these socialites came to John Michael Jewelers, where she worked, for their jewelry needs. Lauren passed A Good Yarn, and the window display instantly caught her attention. She stopped to give it a look and shook her head. Wouldn't you know it? The display in the yarn store's window was a baby blanket. A beautiful baby blanket knit in lovely pastel colors. Lauren wanted to groan. She loved her sister, but there'd always been a friendly rivalry between them. More laid back of the two, Lauren didn't have big career ambitions. Whereas Carol worked as a program designer for a large software company out of California. She'd married her college sweetheart and seemed to have the perfect life. Lauren had dropped out of college after a couple of years and over time had worked at a number of jobs. She enjoyed sales and seemed to be good at it. The irony was that her specialty was engagement and wedding bands. The couples she dealt with were deeply in love and eager to start their lives together. It gave Lauren a deep sense of satisfaction to help them take one of their first steps toward commitment. The bottom line, she realized now, was that Todd was completely content to leave matters just as they were. They got along great and talked frequently. Rarely a week passed without them attending some sort of social event. They would like to spend more time together, but Todd was busy with his broadcasting career. He had his sights set on getting an anchor position and focused most of his attention on achieving his professional goals. "Hello, Lauren," Lydia Hoffman said, coming up from behind her. "Oh, hi." Lauren spun around to greet the owner of the yarn store. Lydia's husband, Brad, had purchased his wife's wedding band at John Michael Jewelers, where Lauren had worked for the past 5 years.
We've just heard Blossom Street Brides by Debbie Maycomber. Maeve Binchy, who left us in 2012, imagined a street in Dublin with a cast of wonderful characters. Every once in a while, she would write about one of these people, then put the story in a drawer for the future, as she would say. The future is now. Chestnut Street is across town from St. Jarlath Crescent, the street made famous in Binchy's beloved Minding Frankie. There, behind closed doors, we encounter people with very different life circumstances, occupations, and sensibilities. There's Lillian, the generous girl with the big heart, and a fiancé whom no one approves of. Bucket McGuire, the window cleaner, who must do more than he bargained for to protect his son. Nessa Byrne, whose aunt visits from America each summer and turns the household upside down. Dolly, who discovers more about her perfect mother than she ever wanted to know. And Molly, who learns the cure for sleeplessness from her pen pal in Chicago. If you miss Binchy's heartwarming writings, this collection of short stories performed by Sile Birmingham will bring you much pleasure.
It was great the way they always found something to talk about. Schoolgirls in a small town. The nuns thought they talked about their careers and plans for living a Christian life. Their parents thought they talked about getting good results in the leaving certificate. The boys and the brothers thought Maura and Deirdre and Mary talked about clothes and records because that's all they ever seemed to be going on about whenever you came across a group of girls in their school uniforms. But in fact, what they talked about was love and marriage, in all their aspects. The love bit would naturally precede marriage, and there were all kinds of love. There was first love to consider, and false love, and love that was untrue, and love that was unreturned, and love that went through difficulties. But then it would all be crowned with marriage. Maura and her friends Mary and Deirdre didn't talk much about love after marriage, because once you got there, then surely that was it. Then everything else would fall into place. Well, of course, you were going to be happy ever after. What was the point of the whole thing if that wasn't the way it would turn out? And wouldn't it be great to be married? Your own home. You could come home whatever time you liked and get up whatever time you liked and eat whatever you liked. You could get chips 7 nights a week if you wanted to. And people would be giving you presents. You got new things, not pillows that generations had slept on, or saucepans that had the bottoms all black. Everything was shiny when you got married. Of course it would be great being married once you had fallen in love and he had fallen in love with you. They were 14 when they thought like this, when you thought the best bit would be being able to come home as late as you like. When they were 15, Maura and Mary and Deirdre talked about the kind of people they would fall in love with. and the general view was that the pool wasn't nearly large enough to choose from. In fact, the choice was particularly limited once you looked around you. Few young women had ever been given such a poor field of exploration. In films, there were casts of thousands. In films, handsome strangers rode into town. In real life, there were the fellas from the Brothers who would make a jeer and call you names. You couldn't love any of them. When they were 16, they got technical. The actual physical business of love. How it was done and the etiquette surrounding it all. Mainly they talked about the first night. Because the first night of marriage would be the first night of making love also. You couldn't think of one without the other. Even in the modern, up-to-date 1950s, only a fool would do what poor Orla O'Connor had done. Her fella had run off to England as soon as he heard the news. And there was Katie, who had to marry the eldest Murphy boy in such a hurry. Katie stayed at home and looked after her enormous baby, the one who was born prematurely after 6 months of marriage. And she never went out anywhere, even though her husband drank like a fish until all hours. Well, he had married her, hadn't he? He had done his duty, faced up to it. He could hardly have a word said against him now. Katie wouldn't want to say a word against a husband who had stood by her at the time of her disgrace, no matter if he drank himself senseless from one end of the county to the other. So these were awful warnings for Moira and her friends Mary and Deirdre. Stronger and more terrifying than 1,000 warnings from the pulpit, school or home, were the two living examples in their own hometown. The feckless Orla and the grateful trapped Katie.
We've just heard Chestnut Street by Maeve Binchy. Relationships are hard work. Robin Carr's newest title, Four Friends, examines the story of four women determined to find their stride. Jerry can't decide what's more devastating, learning her rock-solid marriage has big cracks, or the anger she feels as she tries to repair the damage. Andy doesn't have a great track record with men, and she's come to believe that for her, lasting love is out of reach. When she finds herself attracted to her down-to-earth contractor, she questions everything she thought she wanted in life. Sonia's lifelong pursuit of balance is shattered when her husband declares he's through with her New Age nonsense and walks out. Miraculously, it's BJ, the reserved newcomer to Mill Valley, who steps into their circle and changes everything. Teresa Plummer narrates.
Ahead of them, about half a block away, a small, lean woman came out of her house, also wearing sweats. She stopped to stretch on her front walk. She was still stretching as they passed, and Jerry called, "Morning, BJ." But Sonia added,
"Wanna walk with us today, BJ?"
"Thanks, but I need the run," she answered, waving them off. When they'd cleared the house, Sonia said,
"She's making an awful lot of bad karma, the way she acts."
"She wants to run," Jerry said. "Quit asking her. I'd run if my knees wouldn't collapse."
"But it's unfriendly," Sonia said.
"Some women don't want girlfriends," Jerry pointed out. "I think she's been clear and not unfriendly. Just private."
"Don't you think that's pretty suspicious?"
"No. I think it's private. Are you going to talk the whole time? Because if you are, I might risk permanent paralysis and just run with BJ.
Little grouchy this morning? I bet you had liquor instead of chamomile before bed last night."
"Shut up, Sonia," Jerry said. The 6 a.m. power walking had been going on for almost 2 years. Sonia had initiated it. She was the health guru, the motivator. Often the pain in Jerry's butt. It was Sonia's profession. She was a feng shui consultant and home organizer who did personal color charts and something she referred to as life reading, which was like a mini study of your past, present, and goals with the objective of total balance and personal success. Additionally, she was a vegetarian, novice herbalist, part-time yoga and meditation instructor, and impossible perfectionist. Jerry had an entire shelf dedicated to books given to her by Sonia on everything from studying your body's pH to gliding through menopause on herbs. Books stubbornly left unread. Jerry and Andy had been neighbors and good friends for 15 years, since before Andy threw out her first husband. They were both now in their late 40s, while Sonia had just scored the big 4-0. When Sonia arrived in the neighborhood a few years ago, Jerry and Andy welcomed her and immediately grew bored with her naturalist and metaphysical leanings. However, and it was a big however, when someone was sick or hurt or in trouble, it was always Sonia who came forth with anything from a massage to a casserole to transportation to, well, whatever was needed. After 3 miles in just under 45 minutes, Jerry sweating like a boxer and Sonia glistening attractively, they separated. Jerry entered her house noisily. "Everyone up?" she yelled into the house as she wandered into the kitchen. Phil was sitting at the table with coffee, newspaper strewn around, and his laptop open, going through email and checking the news.
"They're up," he said. "More or less."
The Gilbert kids were 13, 16, and 19. Boy, girl, boy. "You're supposed to make sure they're up, Phil."
"I did,"
he said, without looking up.
"I do every morning."
She trudged up the stairs and started throwing open doors.
"Get up! Don't make me late!"
Then she backtracked to her shower and wondered why the hell Phil couldn't accomplish one simple task. Get the kids out of bed while she was out walking. Despite the fact she was planning to go in late today, it annoyed her. But lately, everything annoyed her, because she was doing the menopause drill and she was often testy. She let the water run over her naked body, cool water to lower her body temperature.
We've just heard Four Friends by Robin Carr. Andre Dubuse grew up in the mill towns on the Merrimack River along the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border. He is the proud son of the late short story master Andre Dubuse, and interestingly, his first cousin, once removed, of acclaimed novelist James Lee Burke. Andre began writing fiction at age 22, just months after graduating from the University of Texas. While working to establish himself as a writer, he worked as a bartender, office cleaner, halfway house counselor, self-employed carpenter, private investigator, and bounty hunter. He's now a full-time faculty member at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. His novels include The House of Sand and Fog, made into an Academy Award-nominated film, and his acclaimed memoir, Townie. Today we'll speak with Andre about his newest work, Dirty Love. Welcome, Andre. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
It's great to be back, Elaine. Thank you.
To begin speaking about your new title, would it be fair to say love's
love is a dirty, rotten scoundrel, and we can't live without it.
Yeah. Let's start with Mark's story, and I love the title, Listen Carefully as Our Options Have Changed. Introduce us to Mark.
Mark is a 56-year-old project manager who months earlier was beginning suspicious that his wife may have been cheating on him. He hired a detective and found out she, in fact, had been cheating on him. And the story begins with them living in this sort of detente where he's living in his attached in-law apartment he built for his mom, sleeping on the couch. His wife's living in the house they raised their kids in. Their kids are grown. And all three adults are living in the same house while she still carries on the affair with her boyfriend. And he wants her back. And he's kind of going down the spiral of life and darkness.
Yeah, he wasn't all perfect, though. He had some issues.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked before, the thing that I love most about writing, really, even when it goes really badly, is it's all about discovery. You discover things about these people that, and they're either true or they're not. One thing I discovered about him was You know, he alienated his wife. He brought his work home. He's a controlling manager, which is very good for his job, but not good for his personal life. I think a lot of us do that. We bring our work home, and it's not always good.
I couldn't decide in another story who to feel sorriest for, Devin or the wife of that no-good philanderer, Robert. Tell us a bit about those two characters.
Well, Devin, in the title story, Dirty Love, is 18 years old. She's fleeing a bad thing at home. She's also fleeing a pornographic film of her online that was taken with a cell phone. And she's living with her 81-year-old great-uncle, Francis, who's a recovering alcoholic, newly widowed after 43 years of marriage, also an ex-school teacher. And she's trying to find her way back. He's having her do her GED test. But every night she goes online to this site called Chat Roulette and looks at strangers, and they look at her. And she's just trying to find her way back to the rest of the population, and it's not so easy. And Althea is the quiet, pregnant wife. She's an upholsterer, and she's Greek, of this philandering bartender who has aspirations to be a poet, though he really seems to use that just to sort of, you know.
Get the ladies?
Yeah, let's put it that way.
Yeah. You know, about Devin, with so many technologies available to connect people, emailing, texting, FaceTime, does it seem to you that people are much more isolated now than they had been?
I think so, but I try not to insinuate my own philosophical beliefs on any piece of fiction, but I may have done it a little bit here, I'm afraid. I do. I actually find this, I've never texted, I'm never going to text, I don't own a smartphone, I'm never going to own one. I think it's so sad that we stare at screens in our hands. I think we're so isolated and lonely now. And I think kids are particularly vulnerable. They think they're having a social life, but they're not. Facebook is not a social life. It's not. It's an addiction, and it's a lonely one.
You teach college, so what do you do when a kid in class is texting and you're lecturing?
Oh, they wouldn't dare consider doing that in my class. I make it very clear. I brought in a framing hammer. I don't do that anymore because it's a little disturbing, but I brought in a framing hammer the first day and said, if your gadget goes off in my room, I'm going to break in little pieces. I said, now look, you may have someone who's on their deathbed, God forbid. You can have it on, you know, against a fleshy part of your body on vibrate. I said, but for the most part, don't ever bring these into my class. Just don't do it. We're here to make contact eye-to-eye the old-fashioned way. And, you know, I give talks to a lot of teenagers, and, you know, I've told rooms of 800 to 1,000 teenage people, I don't want to see one of you looking at your screen. If any of you looks down at a screen in your lap when I'm talking, I'm going to walk off. And I do it in a warmer way than that. And I've had 800 people not look down at their screens. One kid did, and I left the stage and made him turn it off, and I went back on the stage.
Good for you. You know, in thinking about this story of Marla, you are a wonderful observer and recorder of the human condition. So is it better to be alone or to settle for something less than perfect?
Oh, man, huh? I don't know, boy. I don't know. I mean, that's what Marla's wrestling with. She's one of these people who's sort of fallen through the love cracks, and then she finds a man and she's in a relationship and they move in together, and then it gets even more complicated, and she would have found happiness, now she's not so sure. And you're right, that's the big question that story wrestles with. Is it better to be alone or alone in a relationship? And I don't have the honest answer, and I think everyone has to work that out themselves. And I don't know what Marla's going to do, by the way. At the end of that story, I'm not sure if she's going to stay or go.
You know, as we learned in Townie, you had a really tough growing up. I'm sure your children have had it a lot more even. I mean, do you have some grit inside you that you developed because of that, that they maybe don't have?
You know, oh God, Elaine, you're nailing something I wrestle with. And I've talked to other parents of, you know, I'm an affluent guy. My kids live in a big, shiny house. They go to private high school. Our cars start up. We have food in the fridge. You know, I'm in a monogamous marriage for 25 years. They're living a night and day existence that I live. But I do wonder sometimes if I've done them a disservice if my wife and I have done them a disservice by giving them such a sheltered, loving bubble. I think ultimately I haven't, because I think it's better to go into adulthood feeling loved and whole than broken and tattered, like too many people do. But there's a great line from Leon Bloy, the French writer. Man has places in his heart which do not yet exist, and into them enters suffering in order that they may have existence. And I am grateful for the suffering I had as a kid.
Yeah, so you're writing the great American novel and maybe they can't because they don't have that breadth of experience.
Well, then again, I don't know. I see some real ability in my kids, all three of them. My oldest is working on a screenplay now. He's got real writing ability, and it makes me, because let's look at that. I think you're a writer or you're not. You're born with a love of language and words and free falling into your imagination, or you're not. And you know, I do believe that the writing is larger than the writer, and that maybe our personal experiences aren't that relevant ultimately, because the world is so wide and so large, and you can live 1,000 years and still not have you still have so much more to write about. So I'm hopeful that they can create all kinds of art without having had to, you know, go to jail and get beat up so much.
Maybe it's in the genes.
Might be in the genes. There are a lot of us, you know, my daddy and me and 6 others in my family.
Well, are you at work on a new project?
Yes. In fact, speaking of depression. Yeah, I am. I'm deep at work on a novel, and I to just this very day, Elaine, I'm having one of these horrible creative days where I think half of it has to go. But you know, look, you got to practice what you preach. I tell my students this all the time, that just because you want to write something doesn't mean it wants to be written about by you. Half of this novel I'm working on has been feeling forced to me for weeks, and I finally accepted it. It's weird. So it's like when you accept you're in a bad marriage or something. It's a big realization about something you've been denying. You know, I realized, you know, I think this just has to go. Boy, the good news is half of the novel in progress feels like it might have some life to it. And it's just always painful to cut months and months of work. But that's what Faulkner was talking about when he said you have to be prepared to murder your darlings. I actually think the part in the novel that I'm going to kill is probably better written than the part that I'm going to save.
Well, when it does arrive, I know we'll all look forward to it. Thanks so much for stopping by and speaking with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to see you.
And now, let's hear a sampling of Dirty Love, narrated by the author.
It's Charlie. Under the light, his face is beaded with rain, his collar unbuttoned, his tie loosened. And in his eyes is the unfocused focus of a drunk. Shiom, uncle. Shiom. For a millisecond, Francis isn't sure what he's just heard. Come in, Charlie. In the bright kitchen, Francis switches on the burner beneath the water kettle. Charlie stands near the table, his hands at his sides, and even though Francis is taller, he feels slight in his nephew's beefy, drunken presence. Tea, Charlie? Where she sleep? Guest room down the hall. Francis is about to say more, that it's good he's here, but he should probably come back when he's sober, something like that. But Charlie is already halfway down the hall, and Francis is following him. Charlie? Charlie opens the door and walks into a room that surprises Francis. Devon has left the bathroom light on, and it casts itself across the ironing board and unmade bed, clothes strewn around the floor. Yep, Charlie says. Same old, same old. He sits on the edge of Devon's bed and pulls her computer onto his lap and opens it. Charlie, we're going back to the kitchen now. Francis steps forward. He's holding out his hand as if to take the fingers of a child. Come on, Charlie, this is Devon's room. Yeah? She paying for rent, uncle? Charlie's eyes are on the screen before him, his face lighted by its glow. He taps keys, waits, then taps a few more. The hallway is a dark tunnel Francis cannot get through fast enough. That hot, flat light on the pines above those men and boys digging as if their hope itself was digging. Then that first shot before that terrible, cracking barrage of denial. Francis hasn't yelled in years. Has he ever yelled? For what comes out of him now feels so underused he fears he has only yelled in his dreams. Running from Hunt's Jeep to stop what Francis's own people had only filmed. You hear me, Charlie? Get out of my house! Francis has to steady himself with one hand on the table. Down the hallway, Charlie moves slowly, unevenly. A blocky figure in a Brooks Brothers shirt and dark tie. Then he's standing in the light of the kitchen, and there's the low whine of the water coming to a boil on the stove. What's the matter, Uncle? Can't take it? Get out, Charlie.
Can't take your sweet little Debbie doing that? Well, try being her father. Francis's eyes ache. The sides of his head pulse. You think you're better than me, Francis? Do you? I raised her. You didn't. You read her a story once a week. That's all you did. And she's living with you? Give me a break. The water is shrieking now, and Charlie begins to smile, his eyes dark and on something beyond Francis. He turns to switch off the burner, to do at least that, and there Devon stands in the doorway to the living room, her red headphones resting around her neck, her hair sticking to her scalp, her blouse wet enough Francis can see the white strap of her bra. She nods in the direction of her father. What are you doing here? I could ask the same of you, couldn't I? What are you doing here? Freeloading off an old man? Using people? Is that all you're ever going to do with your life, Devon? Devon turns, and what happens next happens as dreams happen. Charlie lunging across the kitchen with the speed a drunk should not have. The thrust of Francis's lower leg. How his foot catches his nephew's ankle, and then Charlie's arms and chest and belly slap the living room rug, and the front door slams, and Charlie lets out a groan, Francis's Buick starting up and pulling away. There's a twinge in Francis's right knee. He has to lean against the stove. You all right, Charlie?
That was Dirty Love by Andre Debuse. Popular author Anne B. Ross has captivated countless readers with her Miss Julia tales. In this 11th installment, Miss Julia renews her vows. America's favorite senior citizen would like to crawl under the covers and stay there. It's bad enough her husband Sam wants them to attend marriage enrichment classes, but when she hears Dr. Fred Fowler will lead the sessions, she's mortified. Yet she can't hide forever, especially when someone knocks friend Francie in the noggin and sends her to the hospital. Cynthia Darlow narrates.
When they came out of the courthouse and got in Mr. Pickens's car for the trip to an out-of-town magistrate's office for that travesty of a ceremony, we followed them. Going to Waynesville for the civil ceremony had been my idea, in order to forestall the Abbotsville Times from making a public announcement as to the exact date of legalization. If the Waynesville paper printed it in their public notices, more power to them, because no one in Abbotsville would see it. Sam and I were to be the official witnesses, for which I was glad, because I intended to make sure the whole thing was done up good and tight, so nobody would be able to talk his way out of it. Lloyd was the happiest of the entire wedding party, and I'm including the bride and groom. In fact, he could hardly sit still, for he was at last getting the daddy he'd never had, and he loved Mr. Pickens to death. And to give the devil his due, Mr. Pickens felt pretty much the same way about him, which was all the more reason to make sure that Mr. Pickens towed the line and kept his shoes under the right bed. Lillian was with us, too. She'd been at the house the day before, even though it was a Sunday, when Mr. Pickens came waltzing in with the announcement to all and sundry that he was marrying Hazel Marie the following morning. With a whoop of joy, she'd immediately started preparing dishes for the wedding luncheon. Lillian was another one who'd fallen under his spell, so he could do no wrong in her eyes. She gave him a lot more credit for good intentions than I did. She'd shown up on that Monday morning dressed in her Sunday church-going clothes, a solid white nylon dress with a red patent leather purse the size of a weekend suitcase, and red patent leather heels that she could hardly walk in. And on her head, she wore a wide-brimmed red hat with silk anemones and a veil on it. That meant that Lillian was the only one of us wearing white, a fact that kept Hazel Marie in tears of recrimination at her own precipitous fall from grace, so obviously apparent from the size of her midsection. It got worse when Lillian happened to mention that Letitia, her great-granddaughter, had wanted to go to the wedding, but Lillian had left her with the neighbor lady. Hazel Marie really started crying then because she couldn't stand leaving Letitia out. "Just hold on," Mr. Pickens said, showing remarkable self-control under the circumstances. "I'll go get her."
"Well, you do that," Lillian said, "and I got to sit here and braid her hair for an hour or two, 'cause she can't go looking like she do now."
I had to step in then, because any further delay in the wedding plans would make a nervous wreck out of me. Go by and get her afterward, Mr. Pickens. She can come to the wedding luncheon. And Lillian, be sure to give her a handful of rice to throw.
Yes'm, that'd do the trick, and she won't know the difference.
So we got them married, and those two rapidly growing infants legitimate. And when all was said and done, that was more important than a properly formal and traditional ceremony, although I was heartsick at the secrecy and the haste with which it had to be done. Chapter 2. I was heartsick over more than that, though for now came the need for explanations and cover-ups and outright lies that in the long run no one would believe. In truth, however, I didn't care whether anyone believed them or not, just so they acted as if they did. Part of the problem was that this time I had no leverage by which to elevate Hazel Marie to a respectable position in the town. The first time, that time when she showed up at my front door with my recently deceased husband's little son in tow, I had steeled myself to stare down the gossip and rumors, the whispers and the titters at how my pillar of the church husband had betrayed me. I did it by accepting Hazel Marie and little Lloyd myself, and furthermore by compelling the town to accept them too. I was able to do it, too, because half the town owed money to Wesley Lloyd Springer's estate, and I announced that I was calling in the notes, because I was sick and tired of my house guest being snubbed.
That was Miss Julia Renews Her Vows by Anne Ross. In Mary Kay Andrews' Save the Date, a Savannah florist is about to score the wedding of a lifetime. One that will solidify her career as the go-to girl for society nuptials. Ironically, Kara doesn't believe in love, even though she creates beautiful flower arrangements to celebrate them. But when the bride goes missing and the wedding is in jeopardy, Kara must find the bride and figure out what she believes in. Kathleen McInerney narrates.
For the past 2 weeks, Lillian had called Bloom at least twice a day, every day. I'll see what I can do, Kara said, being deliberately vague. Ecru or ivory, not white, Lillian repeated. Kara sighed. Of course. What about the flowers? Did everything get delivered? And you've got Tori's grandmother's épergne polished for the bride's table? Everything is absolutely under control, Kara assured Lillian. I've got all the bridesmaids' bouquets finished, and I'll start on Tori's this afternoon, so it will be absolutely the freshest possible. And, Lillian, I have to say the two of you have made the most exquisite flower choices I've ever seen in this town. I should hope so, for what this wedding is costing us, Lillian Fanning said. I'll see you at the church tomorrow. Kara hung up and stuck out her tongue at the phone. Is it hot in here, or is it just me? Bert asked, standing in front of the thermostat and fanning himself with an envelope he grabbed off a stack of bills on her desk. I turned it up last night before I went to bed, but I think it's starting to cool down now, Kara said. Well, I'm roasting, Bert declared. He looked at her closely. You're not having chills again, are you? No, I'm fine. I took the last of those darned antibiotics on Tuesday. I can't afford to get sick ever again. Kara took Bert's hand and placed it on her own forehead. See? Cool as a cucumber. No fever, no temp, no problem. But Bert wasn't paying attention. He was staring at the glass door of their flower cooler. Even through the door, beaded as it was with condensation, it was a grim sight. Uh-oh. Kara flung the door of the cooler open. Oh, God. She couldn't believe her eyes. All the flowers in all the buckets in the cooler were limp, dead, dying. Tori Fanning's bridesmaids' bouquets, so carefully wrapped in their silk satin binding, were toast. She glanced at the thermometer hanging from the top shelf and felt like weeping. It had been at 35 degrees last night before she'd gone upstairs, but now it was at 86. She let the door close and pressed her face against the glass. The reassuring hum of the compressor motor was silent. The cooler is dead, she said, and so are the flowers. The motor must have conked out sometime overnight. Bert reached for the Rolodex on the desk. I'll call the repairman. Didn't he just fix this thing like 6 weeks ago? Kara nodded glumly. He did, to the tune of $300. But he warned me then he didn't know how long it would keep running. When I opened the shop, I bought it off a guy whose pizza place had gone out of business. Turns out this thing is so old, you can't find new parts for it. My guy had to jerry-rig it with secondhand parts he had lying around his shop. What are we gonna do? Kara closed her eyes, hoping for inspiration. I have no idea. All I know is Lillian Fanning will a brick if she finds out about this. You heard me. I just promised her we had everything under control. The most demanding bride I've ever worked with. And this had to happen today. She opened the cooler door again and grabbed the nearest bucket. 3 dozen long-stemmed white iceberg roses were crammed into it, and their heads drooped like so many sleepy toddlers. Dead. She dropped a handful of roses into the trash and reached for the next bucket and the next, repeating the diagnosis and throwing them away. When she was done, the big plastic trash bin was full, and all that was left on the counter was one bucketful of leather leaf ferns. You can't kill these things, even if you tried, Kara noted, and a raggedy assortment of single blossoms that had somehow managed to survive. Bert grabbed one of the pale blue mophead hydrangea blossoms and with his secateurs snipped off the end of the stem. He turned on the faucet in the work table sink, let the water heat up, then filled an empty bucket with hot water. He plunged the first hydrangea in and reached for another. We can save these, he said. I'll reprocess all of them, strip the leaves, trim the stems, put some floor life in the water. They're not all a total loss. I bet they'll perk right back up.
That was a sampling of Save the Date by Mary Kay Andrews. The Matchmaker is a touching new novel from Ellen Hildebrand. 48-year-old Nantucketer Dabney Kimball Beach always had a gift for matchmaking. Some call her ability mystical, while others, like her husband, a celebrated economist, and her daughter, clearly engaged to the wrong man, call it meddlesome. But there's no arguing with her results. With 42 happy couples to her credit, and all of them still together, Dabney is never wrong about romance. Never, that is, except perhaps in her own life. Clendenin Hughes was the boy who took her heart with him long ago when he left the island to become a journalist. Now, after spending 27 years on the other side of the world, Clend is back on Nantucket, and Dabney has never felt so confused or so alive. Aaron Bennett narrates.
Dabney felt like she was being electrocuted right down to her bone marrow. Nina was at her own computer, sucking on her gold cross, a bad habit that had traveled by osmosis across the 4 feet between their desks. Nina said, Dabney, really, what is it? Dabney let her pearls fall from her mouth. They thumped against her chest like they were made of lead. She had not been feeling right for weeks, maybe as long as a month, and now her body was really going haywire. The email from Clendenin Hughes. Dabney forced a smile at Nina. The weather this weekend is going to be perfect, she said. We are going to have guaranteed sun. After last year, Nina said, we deserve it. Dabney said, I'm going to run to the pharmacy for a frappe. Do you want anything? Nina furrowed her brow. Frappe? She glanced at the wall calendar. Theirs each year, courtesy of Nantucket Auto Body. Is it that time of the month again already? Dabney wished she wasn't so predictable, but of course, predictability was her trademark. She only got a frappe once a month, the day before her period was due, which was still 10 days off. I just feel like it today for some reason, Dabney said. Do you want anything? No, thank you, Nina said. She gave Dabney an extra beat of her attention. You okay? Dabney swallowed. I'm fine, she said. Outside, the atmosphere was festive, After 4 cold, punishing months, spring had arrived on Nantucket. Main Street was teeming with people wearing yellow. Dabney spied the Levinsons, couple number 28, whom she had introduced 10 years earlier. Larry had been a widower with twins at Yale and Stanford. Marguerite had never married headmistress at a prestigious girls' boarding school. Larry wore a yellow cashmere sweater and a pair of Kelly green corduroy pants, and Marguerite was in a yellow poplin blazer. She held the leash of their golden retriever, Uncle Frank. Dabney adored all dogs, and especially Uncle Frank. And Larry and Marguerite were one of her couples, married only because she had introduced them. Dabney knew she should stop and talk. She should rub Uncle Frank under the muzzle until he sang for her. But she couldn't fake it right now. She crossed the street to Nantucket Pharmacy, but did not go inside. She headed down Main Street, through the A&P parking lot, to the Strait Wharf. At the end of the Strait Wharf, she gazed at the harbor. There was Jack Copper, working on his charter fishing boat. In another few weeks, summer would arrive in all its crazy glory. Jack waved, and Dabney, of course, waved back. She knew everyone on this island. But there was no one in the world she could tell about this email. It was Dabney's to grapple with alone. Hello. Dabney could see the steamship, low in the water, rounding Brant Point. In the next hour, the chamber office would be inundated with visitors, and Dabney had left Nina all alone. Furthermore, she had left the office without signing out on the log, which was the one thing Von Oglethorpe, president of the board of directors of the chamber, absolutely required. Dabney needed to turn around right this second and go back to the office and do the job that she had been doing perfectly for the past 2 decades. Subject line. Hello. 3 hours later, she opened it. She hadn't planned on opening it at all, but the urge to do so mounted until it was physically painful. Dabney's back and lower abdomen ached. Knowledge of this email was tearing her up inside. Dear Dabney, I wanted to let you know that I am on my way back to Nantucket for an indefinite period of time. I suffered a pretty serious loss about 6 months ago, and I've been slow recovering from it.
That was The Matchmaker by Ellen Hildebrand. Dorinda Jones, a past guest on the Book Report, returns with Sixth Grave on the Edge, book 6 in the devilishly funny Charlie Davidson series. Most girls might think twice before getting engaged to someone like Reyes Farrow, but Charlie is not most girls. She's a paranormal private eye and grim reaper in training who's known to kick up a fuss. Her beloved Reyes may be the only begotten son of evil, but he's dark and sultry and deeply sexy and everything Charlie could hope for. But when the FBI file on Reyes' childhood happens to land in her lap, she can't help herself. She opens it, and then the fun begins. First, Charlie finds a naked corpse riding shotgun in her car. Then, a man loses his soul in a card game. Throw in a lady on the lam and a very suspicious Reyes, and things couldn't get any worse. Lorelei King once again brings Charlie and the rest of the cast to life.
How Noni had managed to fix her insides as well as her outsides, I'd never know. But the guy was good, and Noni was my new best friend. Well, after Misery. And Cookie, my real best friend. And Garrett, my kind of, sort of best friend. And Reyes, my... What was Reyes? Besides the dark and sultry son of evil. My boy toy? My love slave? My 24/7 booty call? No. Well, yes, he was all those things, but he was also my almost fiancé. All I had to do was say yes to the proposal he'd written on a sticky note, and he would be my fiancé for reals. Until then, however, he was my almost fiancé. No, my soon-to-be fiancé. No, my nigh fiancé. Yeah, that'd work. I turned back to the naked dead man, stuffed a couple of Cheez-Its into my mouth, and confessed my latest sin. I'm just kidding, I said through the crackers, regretting the fact that I'd tempted him and now had no follow-up, no punchline. I don't know any girl mocha latte dead man jokes. Sorry to get your hopes up like that. He didn't seem to mind, however. He sat staring straight ahead as always, his gray eyes clouded and watery with age, oblivious of my charm, my clever repartee, and my intellectual wit. He was ignoring me. It happened. Cheese it? I offered him. Nothing. Okay, but you have no idea what you're missing here. I could only hope that one day he'd actually talk to me. Otherwise, this was going to be a very one-sided relationship. First, he had a long scar that ran from under his left arm, over his rib cage, and down until it ended at his belly button. Whatever had caused it couldn't be pleasant, but it could be vital in identifying him. Second, he had a tattoo on his left biceps that looked very old-school military. It was faded and the ink had spread, but I could still make out an eagle with its talons gripping a United States flag. And third, right underneath his tattoo was a surname, presumably his, Androulis. I'd taken out my memo pad and pen and was drawing the tat, since I had yet to find a camera that could photograph the departed. I did my darndest to draw the tat while simultaneously balancing the Cheez-It box against the gear shift within arm's reach and keeping an eye on the Foster's house. Sadly, I sucked at 2 out of 3 of those tasks, mostly at drawing. I'd never gotten the hang of it. I failed finger painting in kindergarten, too. That should have been a clue, but I'd always wanted to be the next Vermeer or Picasso, or at the very least the next Clyde Brewster, a boy I'd gone to school with who drew exploding walls and houses and buildings. No idea why. Alas, my destiny did not lie within the lines of graphite or the strokes of a paintbrush, but at the whim of dead people with PTDD, post-traumatic death disorder. Oh well, it could have been worse. Clyde Brewster, for example, ended up in prison for trying to blow up a sack and save. Thankfully, he was better at art than at demolitions. He'd asked me out several times, too. Hashtag dodged a bullet. I know you're not really into baring your soul, I said, eyeing Mr. Androulis's bare, naked soul, figuratively speaking, but if there's anything you want or need, I'm your girl, mostly because not many people on Earth can see you. I added a shadow on the eagle's face with my blue ink pen, trying to make it look noble. It didn't help. It still looked cross-eyed. And those who can see the departed usually see only a gray mist where you might be, or they'll feel a rush of cold air when you walk past. But I can see you, touch you, hear you, pretty much anything you. Maybe if I added highlights on its beak, it would look more like an eagle and less like a duck. My name is Charlie. But I was using a pen. I couldn't erase. Damn it. I had to think ahead. Real artists thought ahead. I'd never get into the Louvre at this rate.
That was Sixth Grave on the Edge by Dorinda Jones. Readers, so will you take any of these titles to have and to hold, to read and enjoy? Hopefully, you'll say I do. If not, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for books and genres which might be a better match. Thanks for joining me today. I hope to see you back here in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.